how do you pronounce this name? You know, everybody's had their own versions of it. I will tell you how I pronounce it and why. I'm pronouncing it Maikeia. And in the Hebrew, it's almost identical with Micah. So that's where you get the long I. If you take the M-I-C away and put an I-S, you get Isaiah. So Maikeia, Isaiah, that's sort of my justification. Is it the right pronunciation? Who knows?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All in favor? Well, needless to say, this is a rather obscure prophet, not fair. But it's interesting, and we're going to ask some questions about why you think this is so. But his prophecy is found in 1 Kings chapter 22. And before we do anything in the way of prophecy, we're going to read it and maybe discuss the typical and historical elements a little bit. We're going to read verses 1 through 40. Just as an aside, and I think this is important, the exact same account, almost word for word, may also be found in 2 Chronicles 18, 1 through 34. So whatever reason that Jehovah God had in mind, He had this duplicated for us. I want you to think about why that would be. Why is it there twice? Sounds almost a waste of space. We got it here, why do you put it here? There's almost no difference between them. But I think it says something about it. Let's give you the context here. This is during the reign of King Ahab and King Jehoshaphat, who we will see in a moment. Coming at the end of 1 Kings chapter 22, you can kind of place it also during the ministry of Elijah. Now, you remember, if you go back four chapters, what was 1 Kings 18 about? You want to remember? I'll give you a hint. It was a contest of the gods on Mount Carmel. Remember? Jehovah versus Baal? So that was just a couple of chapters here before. And then we go into 2 Kings chapter 1 and chapter 2. You know what that's about? We've been talking about it this morning. There's Elijah finishing his ministry and Elisha coming. So this is nested right between them. It kind of gives you the idea. Well, I'm going to read the account first. And I'm going to make this just a little bit larger for you. Kathy's saying, why don't you put your glasses on? Well, I got my glasses, but I have trouble focusing, so if I think that I have less trouble focusing. All right, here we go. This is 1 Kings chapter 22. I will try to read some dramatically to kind of keep us all awake. We all got full stomachs and we're comfortable here. It's a little warm, so I hope I don't fall asleep. That would be really hard. Okay, 1 Kings 22, verse 1. And they continued 3 years without war between Syria and Israel. Now, there's a million questions I'm going to ask about this, but I'm just going to read it through the first time. And it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel said unto his servants, and I just moved where I was. Know ye that Ramoth in Gilead is ours, and we be still, and take it not out of the hand of the king of Syria? Verse 4. And he said unto Jehoshaphat, wilt thou go with me to battle to Ramoth-Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as thou art. My people as thy people. My horses as thy horses. And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, shall I go up against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, go up, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. And Jehoshaphat said, is there not a prophet of Jehovah besides that we might inquire of him? By the way, I'm reading from King James, but you'll see the Lord is all caps there, and I want to make it plain that there's a distinction here between the prophets, the unidentified prophets, that said, go up. Jehoshaphat's not too comfortable with what they said. Verse 8, and the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there is one man Micaiah, the son of Amiah, whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him. For he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. Then the king of Israel called an officer and said, hasten hither Micaiah, the son of Amiah. And the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, sat each on his throne, having put on their robes, in a void place in the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets prophesied before them. I want you to picture this, you know, from this description. Here's the two thrones. Here's the king of the ten-tribe kingdom, Ahab, and here's the king of the two-tribe kingdom, Jehoshaphat. By the way, have you seen the word, the name Ahab here yet? Interesting. Think about that. And here's the word of prophets, you know, what they're doing, whatever they're doing, and they're gathered out before him at the gate here. In the void spot here, we'll make a comment about that. And Zedekiah, the son of Chenaiah, made him horns of iron and said, thus saith the Lord, that he uses the name Jehovah here, with thee shalt thou push the Syrians until thou have consumed them. And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead and prosper, for Jehovah shall deliver it into the king's hand. And the messenger was gone to call Micaiah, spake unto him, and saying, behold now, the words of the prophets declare good things unto the king with one mouth. Let thy word, I pray thee, be like the word as one of them, and speak that which is good. Now, this is kind of interesting. This messenger here is saying, you heard what everybody else said. You know what to say, don't you? And what does he say? Micaiah says, as the Lord liveth, but the Lord saith unto me, this will I speak. So he came unto the king, and the king said unto him, and you can imagine with all the regality here, Micaiah, shall we go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall we forbear? And he answered him, go, prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into thy hand. And did you see how I just said that? Yeah, go, prosper, whatever. Yeah, go. Now, you say, well, aren't you doing a little interpretation here, Brother David? Well, I am, because I want to make a point. I think that's exactly the manner that Micaiah answered. Sort of whimsically. Because look how Ahab responds. And the king said unto them, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? Ahab picked up on it right away. This was sarcasm. And everybody else could pick on it. So he got a little angry. So Micaiah continues, verse 17. And he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master, let them return every man to his house in peace. What does that mean? Well, that's not good. That's not exactly the same as the prophets, is it? See, it's the army scattered. Verse 18. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee he would prophesy no good concerning me but evil? Verse 19. Micaiah continues. And he said, hear thou therefore the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him, on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, who shall persuade Ahab? By the way, I'm going to pause here. This is the only place in the account where the king's name is mentioned. That he may go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead. And one said on this matter, and another said on that matter. And there came forth the spirit and stood before him and said, I will persuade him. And the Lord said unto him, wherewith? And he said, I will go forth, and I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets. And he said, thou shalt persuade him, and prevail also. Go forth and do so. And now before, behold, the Lord hath put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these 400 that are standing right here. And the Lord hath spoken evil concerning me. But Zedekiah, the son of Chenaiah, went near and smote Micaiah on the cheek and said, which way went the spirit of the Lord from me to speak unto thee? And Micaiah said, behold, thou shalt see in that day when thou go into an inner chamber to hide thyself. The king of Israel said, take Micaiah and carry him back to Ammon, the governor of the city, and to Joash, the king's son, and say, thus saith the king, put this fellow in prison, and feed him with the bread of affliction, and with the water of affliction, until I come in peace. Bread and water for Micaiah. And Micaiah said, If thou return to all in peace, the Lord hath not spoken by me. And he said, hearken, O people, every one of you. Here's my cane in front of this big crowd. He says, remember what I said. And off goes Micaiah to the bread of the prison. Verse 29. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead. The king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, I will disguise myself and enter into battle, but put thou on thy robes. And the king of Israel disguised himself and went into the battle. But the king of Assyria commanded his 32 captains that had rule over his chariot, saying, fight neither with small or great, save only with the king of Israel. So in other words, he said, I want you to zero in on the king. Verse 32, and it came to pass, when the captains of the chariots saw Jehoshaphat, that they said, surely it is the king of Israel. They could see his magnificent robes there. And they turned aside to fight against him. And Jehoshaphat cried out. And it came to pass, when the captains of the chariots perceived that this was not the king of Israel, then they turned back from pursuing him. And a certain man drew a bow at a venture, and smote the king of Israel between the joints of the harness. Wherefore he said unto the driver of the chariot, turn thy hand and carry me out of the host, for I am wounded. And the battle increased that day, and the king was stayed up in his chariot against the Syrians, and died at even. And the blood ran out of the wound into the midst of the chariot. And there went a proclamation throughout the host about the going down of the sun, saying, every man to his city, and every man to his own country. In other words, retreat. They lost the battle. Verse 37. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried the king in Samaria. And one washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. And they washed his armor according to the word of the Lord which he spake. Now the rest of the acts of Ahab, and all that he did, and the ivory house which he made, and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of Israel? Now that chapter continues, but this is the section that we read. So let's talk about what actually happened there. Let's kind of zero in on some of the details. I'll open it up to all of you. What strikes you about this? What are some of the details of this prophecy that are interesting to you? Brother Michael?
Well, the whimsical response, you know, when he knew, the whimsical response, you know, that Micaiah gave him, knowing full well what the truth should be.
Yeah. You know, it's really real, isn't it? Very human, you know. Here's Micaiah, this one prophet of Jehovah, in this massive crowd. You know, and he was told what to say ahead of time. So, yeah, okay, whatever, do what you want. And they all picked up on that, and then he gives us. But that little bit of humor there, that little bit of sarcasm kind of stands out. I like that too. Sister Carrie.
Well, what I see in the very beginning is that Jehoshaphat and Ahab are coming together over a common foe.
Yes.
So how does this tie in with prophecy?
Oh, we're gonna get there. But that's a real important observation. Now notice what we read there, that there, it says there had been no war with Syria 3 years. Well, why is that important? You know, it's like saying, well, you know, there's nothing going on this afternoon. Well, why report it? But it tells us that. But then it says in the third year, so this is actually a little less than 3 years. But obviously there was animosity here, because we find out that the king of Syria had occupied the land of Gilead. Anybody remember where the land of Gilead is? Where in Israel is the land of Gilead?
The other side of
Jordan. Yeah, on the other side of Jordan. When we say the other side of Jordan, the east side of the Jordan, right? Here, just follow my hand motion. So this is the Jordan River and this is Israel. Gilead is right over here. You know, I would say northeast section of it there. You remember what tribes were in that area? There was 2.5 tribes in the area. Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh. That's where they lived. So this was up, I think, around half the tribe of Manasseh. That's where that area was. But it was part of the promised land. It belonged to Israel. And there was the king of Syria. So that's the first thing we notice. Remember, we'd like to get the details of the type down so that we can start to relate it to what the prophecy was all about. So somebody outside is in land that is supposed to be controlled and given to the king of Israel. So they're squatting in there. And that was the hook that Ahab uses for Jehoshaphat. Hey, this is an abomination. They're in our land. Aren't you upset about this? Let's do something about it. And, I don't know. Jehoshaphat, he was a good king. He doesn't sound like that sharp to me, though, does he? A little bit later, what does the king do a little bit later? He puts on the disguise. Well, you be the big guy here. Yes.
I believe that, remember correctly, the 400 prophets were false prophets. God didn't send them anywhere.
Yep.
Not Thou was the true prophet. But the thing in verse 8 says that Jehoshaphat did not hear him prophesy because he didn't like him. He hated him because nothing was prophesied in his favor. So I don't want to listen to him.
Yeah, we already know that Ahab had a history with Elijah, don't we? We know about the 3.5 years of drought and the contest of the gods in that carnival. But evidently, Ahab had a little relationship with this man, because he never says anything good about me. What does that tell you? Well, he's talked to him before. And then later he says, how many times I got to tell you? Which means he had a relationship with him. They knew each other, and it wasn't a good friendship.
That was another point I was going to bring up, and that is the attitude of Micaiah. Because Micaiah knew that the king had power of life and death over him. But despite that, Micaiah was going to be faithful to Jehovah. And he said, I can only speak what Jehovah tells me.
You know, you don't get the idea that Micaiah is very worried here, do you? He seems to be pretty calm. I mean, are you going to use, how many of us will use sarcasm if we got a sword hanging over? But he did. He knew that Ahab had the power of life and death, but he was pretty lackadaisical. That's the wrong word and title. He was pretty confident in what the Lord had him to do. Brother Jim mentioned these prophets, all right? Well, let's get Brother Jim's comment first.
This is a historical note. When Jacob was giving the land to his sons, Manasseh and Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
He says, let's see. Moreover, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite. So this wasn't actually kind of a land that the Lord promised them. It's almost like, well, I take it from the hand of the Amorite. It's like the king of Syria is saying, that's my land. But no, it's Israel, because he took it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there's a nice historical thought there. I might pick up on what you said just a little bit longer. The Amorites never were given any land by God. And so when somebody mentioned earlier, when the iniquity of the Amorites came to the full, it was time to displace them. I might contrast that, and it doesn't have anything to do with this study, but just keep this in mind, that God did give land to Moab and Ammon. And told Israel, you can't have that. That's their land. So we might just take Moab and Ammon out from the other Canaanites in general, and that they did have an inheritance from God, but the Amorites, the other Canaanites, did not. Nice point. Well, back to the prophets. There was 400. Now, in this case, it doesn't say what God these prophets were from, but we might make some guesses. Let's, for a moment in your minds, go back to 1 Kings 18. This is back to Jehovah versus Baal. How many prophets were there? Everybody says 450. And that's the correct answer. There's 450 prophets of Baal. But there was 400 prophets of the groves. And some of the translations say prophets of, I just lost the name, of a female god that was one of Jezebel's gods. Yeah, I think that's right, Ashtoreth. So, or something along those lines. So there's really 850 prophets there. So when the contest went very bad, Elijah says, take the prophets of Baal and slay them. Now, we could take it literally and say that he just threw the 450, and those other 400, they scattered, and this happens to be the same 400. I don't know that that's true. It may be that Elijah threw all 850 there. But we make the connection because it mentions 400 prophets there, and it mentions 400 prophets here. So if they're not the same, we'd say there's a pretty good connection here, some sort of a connection. All right, anything else that turn around, please?
Regarding the 400 bad prophets, as we might call that, false prophets, they instructed Micaiah to tell the king what they told the king. And I'm just thinking that, being that they were evil, Micaiah's life might have been in jeopardy. So he tells the king what they told him. He tells the king in a language that the king would understand that he's being sarcastic.
Very nice.
So now when the king orders him to tell me what God told you, so now he's under oath, he has to tell the truth. So he's protected from both sides.
What a great comment, huh? That's a magnificent comment. He did what he was told, didn't he? I didn't think about this, but Michael, I'm really glad you brought that. They told him what to say, so he said it. And then he was told to say the right thing, and so he's covered. Beautiful observation. That was great. Brother Jim.
I just wanted to add that the true prophet of God will always go to God and seek to what he needs to tell. These prophets in verse 6 says, they didn't even think about it. They said, yeah, go up. The Lord will deliver you. So true prophet will always go to God and ask what shall I say.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, here's another little thing, and if you've got other things that stick out with you in the account, by all means raise your hand. In verse 10, we have a description here, and the king of Israel and Josaphat, king of Judah, each sat on his throne, having put in their robes, in a void place, in the entrance of the gates of Samaria and all the prophets. What does that mean, in a void place? If you look at some other translations, you find a more familiar term to use.
Comment that is the way out here. We decided that was the question.
Yes.
And so that indicates the separation.
Yeah, very good. The threshing floor. So we're only bringing up all these details in the original picture here to help us to see what we can come up with in connection with what it all means. Yes, Sister Dawn, please.
Doesn't that also help us with timing? If it's a threshing floor, then it's at the end of the harvest? The end?
Sounds good to me. She's jumping ahead. No, that's good. That's really good. Other things to know, do you notice the cooperation between the two kings? What did Jehoshaphat say? You know, hey, the two kings were together, our peoples are together, and our horses are together. You know, so, again, we're just making observations here. Zedekiah, who was the leader of the false prophets, what Micaiah said to him at the end there is that you're going to go hiding in the inner chamber. Take a note of that, right? He's going to flee into the inner chamber. It doesn't sound like he's going to make it much further than that, but he's going to hide. Lastly, maybe not so lastly, let's just talk about the conclusion of the matter. The two kings lost the battle to the Syrian kings. They lost it. And during that battle, you remember that there was the disguise, and they come after Jehoshaphat, but he survives, and they finally, purely by accident, or coincidence, or providence, Ahab gets wounded. It says there, it sounds to me like it was just a chance thing, but nothing was chance with God. He gets wounded and he dies. And then it says that his blood was all over the chariot. And it says, according to the word, what was one of the prophecies regarding Ahab's death? Brother Richard.
Well, you would think that his death was linked to the permission of Jezebel to have the worship of Baal and so forth. But actually, it is directly linked to his falsely having Naboth and his sons stoned as blasphemers so that he could take their vineyard. And so the prophecy was that in the place where their blood had been spilled, the dog would lick up the blood of Ahab.
Perfect. And that prophecy, by the way, is in the previous chapter, 1 Kings 21, verse 19. We don't take time to read it. But that licking of the blood and the place where that blood is processed was prophesied. Sister Suzanne.
In the King James Version, it doesn't use accurately as pronounced the ESV on verse 28. It says, and they washed the chariot by the pool of Samaria, and the dog licked up his blood, and the prostitute washed himself in it.
Interesting. That's in the Chronicles of
that? No, I'm reading 1 Kings 22, 38 from the ESV version.
Oh.
And other versions bear out that in the Hebrew it's the prostitutes who wash in his blood.
Wow. That's something I hadn't picked up on. Interesting. We can draw that in as well. Very good. What is one of the things that Zedekiah does to demonstrate how thoroughly Ahab and Jehoshaphat would win the battle? What does he do? He's very demonstrative. Sister?
Horns of iron.
It's right. Sister Rochelle, she makes horns of iron. So if you'll picture this. So he basically put on a two-horned headdress, didn't he? And I express it that way for a reason. I say two-horned, Sister Karen is smiling. These are all connections we're trying to make in the picture here as we start to try and figure out what it looks like. So I'm just scanning all of what we talked about. Anything else that anyone observed in the title, in the actual historical event that you think is of interest? Okay. Well, what we're going to endeavor to do now is figure out some ways in which this might have prophetic meaning to us. I will tell you at the outset, I'm not too focused on particular ideas. I have a few ideas, but I'm more interested in your ideas. I would say where I am, I like the way Brendan expressed it. You know, here's a study and here's a discourse. I'm definitely not at the discourse level, but I'm in here and you can see this is rich in detail and familiar detail. Where did they lose the battle? Ramoth-Gilead. Have we heard a bunch about Ramoth-Gilead already? So you can see this connects in with a number of other prophecies as well. What does it all mean? Well, let's see if we can figure something. Let me start out by asking a question I alluded to earlier. Is there any significance, I'm in my question list now, here's question one. Is there any significance to the duplication of the account? That is in 2 Chronicles and in 1 Kings, almost word for word. Sister Carol says yes. Okay, next question. Now, let's just get around a little bit. Sister Kathy.
As a certain husband of mine has said many a time before, when you see something pointed out specifically another time, whether it be a second or a third time, we should pay particular attention to it because there's something very significant there.
Yeah, you know the expression, through the mouth of two or three witnesses? We've got two witnesses here. And you and I both know that God is not wasteful, especially with the scriptures. This is his word. So the fact it's in there twice, I think, gives us some authority to say, let's look closely at that. There must be something significant in here enough for God to repeat it to us. And by the way, I didn't go through with a fine-tooth comb, but I looked at both accounts and I didn't see much difference. I mean, they're almost verbatim. So this doubling is in fact almost what it is. All right, anything significant in the start of the account that says, and for 3 years there was no war? Anything significant about the number three?
Well,
by the way, I will tell you that there are some questions here I don't have an answer to. So you're like, oh, what is it first time? I'm not sure either. Any thoughts? Well, I will give, oh, Sister Karen. Thank you.
Well, something happens so that the powers would say, peace, peace. So this would be the false peace that come before the storm.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it was, exactly. It gave time for them to be tempted to come in there. You know, when you see the number three, and I think it was Brendan that mentioned this earlier, we see three, number three associated with the church a lot of times. Remember the three sons of Noah, the three bands of Gideon. You know, I'm not positive if that's the connection we want to make here, but I'm thinking that this may be an early flag saying that there's some lessons here about the church at the very end of the age and what goes on. A suggestion. Yes, Brother Michael, please.
There seems to be a few threes involved in this. I have a note in my Bible that it was Ahab's third campaign against Aaron.
And it, can I pause there? No, notice that Brother Michael said Aram there. That is another translation for Syria. You know, the king's there, that's that. In fact, that's the Hebrew word for Syria, Aram, just so that you understand that. Go ahead, brother.
And it was also in the third year of Jehoshaphat that it was the 3 years of
peace. I didn't know that.
3 years of peace, 3 years of Jehoshaphat, and 3 years for the third campaign.
Wow. So we got a bunch of threes going on. Brother Jim.
I tell you the point of being in the caves and in Chronicles. I've been heard the explanation to be that Samuel and Kings, basically, are a continuation of one book. And quite a man's point of view when it comes to Samuel and Kings. But when you get to Chronicles, God's point of view. More detail. Words of the day of the event. There's a lot more sequence there of what really went on. And so you're getting two different views. And if you notice throughout all the scriptures, your word doesn't have a second or third witness. Mm-hmm. Your word. It's spoken again like the Book of Psalms. Book of Psalms is coverage of the first five books of the Bible, basically. Or the Moses, the Book of Moses, are all reiterated as it were in the Book of Psalms.
Very
good. It's a very interesting point.
Very good. In one of my questions that I know that we'll see another three that comes up in connection with this, so there seems to be several. Yes, Brother Ross, please.
Yeah, this was a study somewhere along the line on threes. And of course it's hard to pin down, you know, certainly, but it seems like there's a connotation of trouble associated with the number three. Maybe completeness through trouble. Because the three occurs in many, many, many instances, you know, outside of the citations already given. So we can look at the account of Samson. Love it, the three is there, and just go on and on.
Yeah. And I like the association made there with trouble. Again, this association also always seems to come back to the church, but someone mentioned it yesterday. Remember, after the trial, or after the competition of the gods, Elijah flees to the mountain, and God talks to him. And then, you remember the three things that he shows him? Wind, earthquake, fire. There's trouble. And all associated with his own experiences, those three things. Yeah, I'm sure we could multiply them. We mentioned Ramoth-Gilead. I'm going to maybe direct this question to Brother Richard. What else happened in Ramoth-Gilead? What other things?
Well, Ramoth-Gilead was one of the 10 district capitals that Solomon had constructed. Of course, its principal its purpose was to serve as the first line of defense against Syria. So we have this fight at Ramoth-Gilead, which, you know, sometimes brother get confused with Armageddon, because he was getting killed there. My mind was going to blank, brother.
That happens to me all the time. I worry about it.
Servants.
It's really bad when you're up here and you mind those things. They met at the gate of Assyria. We mentioned the open place there was threshing floors. So I want to reiterate that, that as we start to look for meaning, we're looking for something at the end of the gospel age, almost the very end, threshing, the separating that goes out. The cooperation between the two kings involved three things. You and me are like one, our people are like one, and our horses are like one. So there's three lines of cooperation. By the way, can we read any other meaning out of that? Kin, people, horses? What do you think? Good. Sister Dawn.
Well, the horses, I think, are the obvious, because we think of horses as doctrine. Mm-hmm. So we've got two kings over two areas that are saying that doctrines are one. And we talked about in the previous study that oftentimes that the 10th tribe kingdom is a picture of Catholicism, and the 2th tribe kingdom picture of Protestantism. So their idea of saying, the doctrine's going to work.
Very good, very good. And actually, you kind of brought us right to where I want us to be now. We're trying to interpret this in an end-time scenario. Now, what Dawn just said is one of the key elements here that we recognize in the 10-tribe kingdom, that portion of Christendom that is more Catholic. And when you think about the worship of Baal and whatnot, you get right into the Catholicism itself. This is Christendom. This is the kingship, the civil part of Christendom associated with Catholicism. And with Jehoshaphat, you have that part of Christendom that's associated with Protestantism. I like both of those thoughts. And somebody asked me yesterday, is it in connection with the 10 tribes and the 10 toes? I don't know the answer to that, but obviously we've got some associations we can make here. Sister Kelly, please, and then Brother Richard.
It's probably a big stretch, but the king's horses of people, could that somehow relate to the hour of power, the name, the number, and the mark?
Possible. Brother Richard.
We had a study before lunch on Jehu and the location for that whole drama was again Ramaphilia. So that's the other significant one. The first one that we're looking at here, this historically earlier one, leads to the death of Ahab, and then the one that's separated by two kings is going to lead to the death of Jezebel and Ahab's house, as well as the death of the king of the visiting group from Judah.
Okay, very good. Let's see. Sister Dawn and then Sister Robin.
Just by the people, my people and thy people. Thinking of the idea of come back to the mother church, you know, there's one mother, you all are daughter. They say that.
That sounds reasonable to me. It's just wrong.
Yeah, and Joshua 21:38 talks about Ramoth and Gilead as the city of refuge. And if the 2-tribe kingdom Protestants go to the 10-tribe kingdom Catholicism, they will join back together Catholicism to fight for the city of refuge, then is this the peace for very good
Very nice. Nice connection. Just listening to Brother Richard a moment ago, as we get a little bit closer, probably you're going to have suggestions of where to place this in the stream of time. And we haven't asked yet who the king of Assyria represents. But I think that this represents a development which precedes the development that Richard was talking about with Jehu. With Jehu, everything comes to completion. All of those, and we discussed when we studied that in the picture of Jesus, just doing cleanup work. But this is something that I think occurs, a development that occurs before that. And I say that because it doesn't necessarily have to be. It could be a picture of the same thing. But there's too many differences here where, in my opinion, I don't think it is a duplicate picture of the picture of Jesus. And then we'll get a little bit more into that as well. You mentioned the two horns. Well, let's go right to the question. Who does Syria and the king of Syria, and Syria being in the land of Gilead, represent? I'm hoping somebody else will open this box of apples here and then we can start to fill in. All right. Here I go on the way. You know, I have listened to studies that brethren have done through the years, and there's been various ideas, but I think we can update it with a feeling of comfort. I say comfort because things can change and it might be right, but some of the suggestions that brethren gave some years ago, the political changes have taken place where things are not quite the way they are. But we spoke yesterday, at least last night, we were talking about radical Islam. And we mentioned that radical Islam had its start in Iraq, you know, which was ancient Babylon. And Syria was closely associated with it. So let me just lay out how it seems to me now, and I'm not married to this thought, but it appeals to me. I'm going to suggest, and this is not unique to me, this part of it, that these two kings of Christendom, Catholicism and Protestantism, center primarily in the European theater of events. We're talking about what's going on in Europe, in the churches in Europe. Sort of taking the United States out, putting them in an observer status. You know what's happening now with refugees from Syria and from elsewhere there in the Middle East. Where are they going, folks? They're going to Europe. They're spreading throughout Europe. And what are they bringing with them? Jihad. Right? Not at all saying that they're all doing that, but we've already seen developments that you have folks from another country, another area of the world, settling into the Christian nations. And you see the connection that I'm making between the king of Syria being in the land that belonged to these nations. Literally, in Europe, these are Christian Western nations. Well, they're nations of Christendom. There's so much unchristianity. We won't get into that. But they are historically nations of Christendom. And here comes these hordes. And hordes is the right word. Because they are not merely coming to find a place to escape. They are coming to a place that they want to change. And your brother Rick led us through this in our discussions last night. So I'm going to suggest that the king of Syria here, and he's not mentioned too much, it's just his armies are there, and the people that are there, are represented by what we see in this day and age. Now, what does it say about the result of that battle? They win. Well, that's pretty substantial, isn't it? Last night we were talking about ISIS wants to blow up the Vatican. I think this is all in it. I think this is all suggesting the same thing. But that's the enemy that Christendom is fighting against, and they're not going to fare well. The bringing in of the two-horned beast there, of the general authorities, you had the Church of England and Ireland, they will be involved in this as well because they're part of the Protestant, part of Christendom. I like the two horns, two tribes, and there's Jerusalem. That's the overall. What do you think? What's wrong with it? What's right with it? Let me just see your feedback. Brother Richard.
Well, there's parts of it that are good, but I would not characterize what happens at the battle as a win for Syria. There was a lucky bow shot that the Lord overruled, which brought down Aden. Okay. But basically, you don't see the Syrians advancing from this point. So I wouldn't jump to, you know, I wouldn't necessarily go to the conclusion that they won, but they did kill Aden.
Okay, so let's just take your thought here and massage this a little bit. The Israel and Judah basically withdrew from the battle. And they did not displace the enemy.
enemy remains there, enemy remains in control, and one of the kings is killed. So as opposed to like a standard military victory, because it does say that they returned to their homes in peace. You're right, they didn't chase. But they remained in the area that was contested. Okay, Sister Moore.
Just along that line, in 1 Kings 22:31, the king of Syria commanded his captain, saying, fight neither with small or great, save only the king of Israel. So he was the target of this.
So we have it, if our interpretation is correct, being consistent, is that the Catholic portion of Christendom seems to be particularly a target. And we already saw that, at least with respect to ISIS, to take up that. Who like Zedekiah, the chief of the prophets? Now we're talking about just the religious component here, not the religio-political component. Who might Zedekiah represent? Does he represent anybody? Being consistent, what would you say that he represents?
He would have to, I think, because he prophesies on behalf, he's an individual that essentially is there to counteract, looks like he's a hired gun called in to counteract the, I speak for Jehovah, because he's the first one to use that, and to counteract Micaiah's message. So it would appear to be someone who favors both the Union and their decision to go up united to battle against Syria to retrieve Ramoth-Gilead. And so either in the nominal sense or otherwise, perhaps the Orthodox Christianity or something. These are, I think, Jehoshaphat and Ahab represent civil elements.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And, that would be it.
Okay. By the way, here's a quick list of meanings of names. I probably should have done this before we started talking about it. But I went through some of the names here. Syria, Reverend Michael mentioned earlier his comment that Abram means elevated or exalted palace, citadel, fortress. Jehoshaphat means Jehovah has judged. Ramoth means heights. Gilead means rocky region. Micaiah means who is like God. We mentioned earlier, it's the same as Michael and Micah in Hebrew there. So who is like God, that's what all of these mean. His father, Emiah, means whom God will fill up. Zedekiah means Jehovah's righteousness. And Chenaanah, however you pronounce that, you get too many vowels and consonants, I don't know where to go, means traitor. So I don't know if these fit in. Maybe when we get to the discourse stage, we'll fit them all in. So these are the religious points. This is a chief leader here. Could he represent papacy in connection with the head of the Church of England, the Church of Iron? Come together, possibly. We are told specifically they are false prophets. What does the false prophet in Revelation represent? See, now we're getting into Jim's area here. I'm bringing these up as questions. They're defined as false prophets. It says there's a lying spirit in the mouth, so they're false prophets. So can we, without seeing the term false prophet, then make the connection with Revelation? Maybe. And we certainly can with the 200s. So you've got the religious element that is quite vocal in support of what's going on here, and certainly adversarial to what Micaiah says.
Brother David, just to make an observation, because we are interested in the image of the beast and so forth. You have to be struck by the fact that Zedekiah didn't just get up and prophesy. There was forethought and technique to actually get out and get over to a blacksmith and get these iron horns forged that he could use for this little demonstration. So there was forethought and literally making an image of a beast. Not that I'm saying, I have to really think about it, whether that links in, but he made an image of a beast.
I like the way that Brother Richard just got it. I really have to think about it.
one of the purposes of this study, at least as far as I'm concerned, is to just start, get us thinking about it. This is an obscure prophecy. It hasn't had a lot of airtime and discussion among the brethren. But I wanted to really dig down to a lot of the details so that we can get some conversation going about it and some suggestions. I'm throwing out suggestions that are appealing in certain ways, but have defects in other ways. But looking for feedback, and you know, perhaps you can make a link or connection that we have, and you come up with something additional. All right, Jim, please.
Just thinking of the two horns of the that first you have also says that we should.
That's the point.
Thinking about Revelation 16, where it talks about the they go forth and gather the kings from Europe to the battle. If you think like pre-World War I, okay, that they were making all these agreements with all of the kings and stuff. Well, if you go to war against them, then we'll go to war against them. Okay, they're making all these agreements. It's sort of like the false prophets, you know. They were thinking of doom, you know, if something happens, something bad would happen, well, you'll help me, or this person will help me. And they basically made all these agreements, which ended up getting them all into the war. So, that could be the four, you know, the 400 prophets, that they were basically looking for to do and what to do about it, and they all got involved.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Sister Carol.
I'm reminded of Daniel being called to read the writing on the wall, and the timing of that is the description of the little block.
Right. That scene in Daniel is amazing, isn't it? I mean, the enemy is at the door and they don't know it. I just want to go back for a moment with respect to the suggestion about the Arab invasion. Is that, you know, this opens up, it says that for 3 years there was no war. Almost as a suggestion that the permeation of Syria into the land of Gilead took that time. And it was unopposed during that time. Which means that that period of time may, in fact, if our interpretation is correct, also the border, reflects the time now. We're like into year one of the permeation of the Arab world, so it is the Arab immigrants into Europe, and sort of a suggestion that it would continue for a couple more years before we saw anything that would correspond to the actual battle. What does the camouflage of Ahab mean? I'm going to take my regal robe off. I'm just going to sort of sit in the background. You be the big kahuna here. You be the one that's running the show. Sister Karen.
I can see that what things they are. Like you said, they're in the UN, but not voting members, and they're trying to get others to do things. They're pushing that, you know, they have a history of economic success and keeping unity, and that's why the UN and everybody should listen to them. So they are doing things behind the scenes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. And I like your expression there, behind the scenes, because that's what it is. He also wanted to take himself out of being a target. That was the personal reason. Sister Michelle.
Well, I also think it's a way of preserving. I'm going to dress in your clothes. I'm going to hide behind you. But you go ahead. I'll look down and be
sure. I like that. Self-preservation.
I think we had something similar in the John the Baptist type.
Okay, sure.
And that is that Herodias was behind the scenes, but she was pulling the strings. She sent Salome out to the front. So it looked like Salome was running the show, but she wasn't.
I like that connection. The only trouble I have with it is that it's Ahab the king that is being camouflaged.
But didn't you say that, you know, I mean, I use the term
Catholicism, Protestantism. But you clarified that by saying that it's really the countries of Catholicism and Protestantism. So it really is the governments at that point.
I'll go over that. That's good. All right, any other suggestions on the disguising of Abram? By the way, I pointed this out, but didn't ask the question. Can you think of a reason why Ahab, through this whole account, except for one place is called King of Israel, and it says the King of Israel and Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat and the King of Israel doesn't give his name except in that parable. Any thoughts on why that might be?
I think whenever that happens in the Bible, it's to put the person in the lower, that's an insult. It's to put the person in the lower level. So, for example, we don't know the name of Lot's wife. We don't know the name of Solomon's Egyptian wife. We know the name of the architect that built her house. We don't know her name.
Okay. Sister John.
Another suggestion, and that is that when we think of Ahab, we normally think of Ahab and Jezebel,
mm-hmm.
and we think of civil power and papacy, the Catholicism. I wonder if the reason that Ahab isn't mentioned here, but he's referred to as the King of Israel, is that the Lord is giving us the hint to say, it's not the same picture. Not the same type. It's something different here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I like that. It, as you suggested here, that Jezebel is not mentioned at all. What she represented is in Zedekiah and the prophets, but she is not represented at all. So, it's just kind of.
My thoughts were kind of along Sister John's line, that we don't get hung up on the timeline with the next. Because there's 14 years before the death of Hope, and this is taking out of place, and like I said, it's a different picture, it's not in that timeline.
Okay. Any other suggestions? What does the death of Ahab mean? What does that represent? And is it significant that he dies here on the battlefield? But his blood makes it all the way back to the seat of government. Sister Michelle.
Could in some way be a retribution for the death of humanity?
Yeah, typically it was. That's right. How about answer to that? What did that show?
Yeah.
The saints. Okay. Like that. The new saints, that's a real good connection. He was falsely accused and put to death. So we have some retribution here. Okay. Just kind of.
Could it possibly show the far regionness on it? It's affecting the wide area, not just the localized area.
Yeah, it's possible. Well, certainly the incident with Naboth, although it only goes back one chapter from an antitypical standpoint, they have been killing the saints since 539 and before. So we're sort of maybe retrospective that. Okay, Sister Carol, please.
I have a note that it's the end of the hour power.
Thank you. Is there any significance to the fact that Jehoshaphat gets chased, says he cries out, but he survives? By the way, most of these questions I don't have an answer for yet, so. And I've been thinking about it for weeks, so don't feel bad. Well, remember, we said that Jehoshaphat represents the Protestant segment of Christendom. So, if we apply what we know, then the Protestant seems to have a survival a little bit past that of the Catholic element.
In other words, yeah. Sister Robin, please.
Although it was Jehoshaphat that wanted the prophet of Jehovah to speak, and then disregarded everything he said. So it was a willful disobedience, and the Lord's mercy saved him out of that, but I'm not sure why.
You know, I don't have it written down, but the other Jehu the prophet, I think it's Jehu the prophet, could be wrong about that, but he chastises Jehoshaphat. Basically, he says, well, why are you cohorting with those that hate Jehovah? You know, and there's going to be punishment for you, you know, but since you're really a good king, you know, we're going to do some nice things for you first. So there was some culpability for not listening and for going up with Ahab as well. By the way, we very briefly mentioned, you know, what was Jehoshaphat like? He was a good king. You know, he's painted as a good king, but he did have character flaws. And my impression is that he was not the sharpest tack in the room, because several times, I mean, it doesn't take it too much to say, well, if this king's camouflaged, no, I'm not, I'm a target. He didn't seem to get that. You know? But easy to say that from this end of the room, but this end of history, isn't it? Sister Robin.
Just back on that thought, I mean, could he even picture the great company slash mercy class, because they, you know, they know what the Lord's will is, they don't quite follow it. He could come more to the pressure of Ahab and wanting to follow after Ahab than he did Jehovah, and, but then he saved out of it ultimately after he cried out.
Definitely some parallels there. I mean, my first negative reaction to the thought is that we're talking about kingship here. But you pointed out some real parallels between the two and between his behavior and great country behavior. That's a good suggestion. That's what I'm thinking about. All right, any other suggestions? How about we mentioned that Ahab's blood makes it bad? And as we've already seen, it was licked up by the dogs. What might that represent? And I would ask you to think back to our discussion of current events last night. Somebody said, what do dogs represent? Somebody said it.
Gentiles.
Right? And in particular, the heathen Gentiles. I mean, the word for Gentiles is heathen. And what we're suggesting is that these Islamic immigrants, they're heathen. They're bringing Islam up. So it sort of suggests that there is blood to be spilled, and the heathen participate that in it very strongly.
I mean, yeah, well, on that specifically, it makes you, draws you to, clearly to, you know, they're bloodthirsty. They lick up the blood. They do it with Jezebel. They do it with Ahab. And so it's obviously a bloodthirsty element within the heathen world. And I think, at least at this point, I can't come to a better conclusion or see a better fit than this Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, they are literally bloodthirsty. They're crucifying Christians hundreds every day. They're beheading people and putting it on, you know, while they're shouting, you know, Allah Akbar. And I mean, it's like they have a blood lust that's insatiable. And it does remind you, I was looking at some of the earlier study notes, the French Revolution, that's exactly what happened. They were so bloodthirsty that it got to the point where there were so many beheadings once the rebellion was in full swing. The French Revolution was in full swing, that if they looked at you and you weren't cheering and all happy and, you know, participating in the celebration of the heads rolling, and there's even a thought that there are many accounts of the guillotine not going all the way through, them having to do it like two or three times. There was even a thought that they enjoyed that more, so they began to dull the guillotine blades a little bit, so it would take extra time in order for them to And, you know, instead of it was originally designed as a device of a merciful killing, as it were, quick, and they actually turned it into a device that took more time. So, but if you weren't cheering, then they would look at you and wonder, what's your problem? How come you're not? So you couldn't even be ambivalent about it, or neither for nor, you know, you couldn't have a neutral position in it, because they were just as likely to snatch you out of a crowd if you weren't at the cheering and put you up there simply because you refused to enjoy the moment.
I haven't heard that about that before. Brother Tim, then Brother Richard.
Brother Dave. Brother Dave, quick question. Is there anything here, and this dog's lapping up the blood seems to come up quite a few times now, and, you know, God's telling the Jewish people, you shall not eat anything with blood. So to me, this is such a disrespect, nor practice deviation or soothsaying and Deuteronomy. Is there something here that, you know, just a characteristic of these dogs? I mean, they seem to pop up, and we kind of, you know, identify, but I think we also, here's the Lord saying specifically, you know, the blood is, a life has been taken.
Right. I'm sure for a Jew that these pictures were especially repulsive and revulsive because of the sanctity with which they held the blood. And, of course, having a dying and then having dogs eat your blood, you couldn't think of anything much more shameful than that. Brother Richard. And then Sister Dawn.
Well, Brother, I do have to just make a point that in how this whole account fits together, at least from my mind, I'm on a very, very different timeline than the consensus of the brother here, because I place the death of Ahab at the end of the Gentile times in 1914. Jezebel survives. The real belief that the kings are there by the grace of God is still beyond the British point, but basically nobody believes that after World War I. That ended. And that whole system ended. And for the Naboth's vineyard, in my consideration of what that picture is, I think it's actually linked back to the massive colonialization of European powers. They wanted the fruitful vineyard that wasn't theirs, and they got it. And then the Lord, and they got it in a way that was not, well, it involved murdering Naboth and his family. So, you know, as I'm listening to this, I'm hearing it projected further into the future. I would suggest that, no, you've got the end of the Gentile times in 1914. Ahab comes to an end. You have a short-lived son of Ahab who is horrific and worships the gods of the Philistines, and he passes away shortly, which, to my mind, fits with the rise of those dictatorships following the First World War. And then you have a long and more peaceful period after that with the second son in succession. But Jezebel's still alive. So I think I've got a timeline that, at least in my mind, is consistent, and I'm looking at the application of some of these elements back during the kind of leading to the end of that old order.
Yeah, hold on to the microphone just a second. You know, I appreciate that. And it's very possible that we have several different pictures here that go on in different ways. You're looking at a string of kings and making an application. And I like your application. If you were to stick with the death and the surrounding pieces here that we've been talking about, Micaiah's prophecy and whatnot, do you have a suggestion of how that would fit in the 1914 application? That's aside from the timeline picture.
Right. For the for Micaiah, you have the preaching that basically the church state system is not blessed by the Lord.
that simply is not the Lord's arrangement, and trying to tie them with the specific,
you know, with the Syrians and the battle there, and
with Micaiah itself, I haven't looked specifically to try to think of that in terms of the prophecy, but you know, in terms of what he does to warn those nations going into the battle that they're not with them, that could be anybody, including the truth movement, that said, hey, 1914 is going to be the end of this old order of things.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to ask Brother Richard about that question, because we mentioned this in passing yesterday in our study of the Song of Solomon, that there are many pictures in Scripture, and we have to be careful, again, with Butterfly, you said don't mix the pictures. And mostly that was in connection, but it's true with prophecies as well. The timeline, the sequence of kings and whatnot that Brother Richard just mentioned, has a good deal of appeal to me. And I would segment that out apart from this as a separate picture and say, yeah, when you're looking at the relationship of Ahab and Jezebel's not mentioned here, so, and their sons and that timing and whatnot, I like what it gives us for 1914 onward. But even, admitting that, I wouldn't dismiss this as having a special application in many times, especially since it's doubled, which we're giving it to. So there's something really important.
This is back on the dark looking the blood. I don't know if you want to move on because the time.
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, just a couple of scriptures and to me the emphasis is, and these things have really kind of been mentioned, but the emphasis is in 1 Kings 21:19, where it says, thus saith the Lord Jehovah. In the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth's shell, dogs lick thy blood in the night. So really a retribution for what they haven't done. And then tying that with Revelation 6:9-10, those that were under the altar, the souls of them that were slain for the word of God, and they cried, how long, O Lord, will we through? The judge can avenge our blood. So to me that, you know, the dogs were used as the method. But the reason for it was God's justice being satisfied.
Okay, thank you. I want to ask Urban, please.
For a while now, I've been thinking, and maybe I actually heard it in a discourse from Brother Richard, but for a while now, I've been thinking along similar lines, Ahab, World War I, etc. And ultimately, your task was to determine precisely who Micaiah represents and why. So
actually, that's the next question.
Okay.
I haven't asked that question.
All right, good.
But you may proceed. That's
okay.
Good.
So, but the World War I now, in one of the studies in the study notes from Rockland, he feels that in the Micaiah picture, the odds were similar for him. Therefore, the Micaiah type seems to fit the French Revolution time setting, which involved lying spirits. Two definitions are important. The pastor ingeniously suggested that the King of Israel represented Catholicism because the northern kingdom of the 10 tribes was more numerous than Judah, which had only 2 tribes. Thus, some pictures, the King of Israel represents papacy and the King of Judah represents Protestantism. As a result, the French Revolution kept Catholicism received a deadly blow. To the contrary, the Bible societies were all of Protestant origin. And it was interesting that the decline of, after the French Revolution, the decline of the papacy, at the same time, Protestantism was skyrocketing. The Bible societies were popping up everywhere and everything was happening. But bringing it back to the World War I, you know, reading a couple of things just happening online, says, you know, World War I occurred between July 1914 and November 1918. By the end of the war, over 17 million people were killed. And they list 5 reasons why World War I, what the root causes were. And number one was the mutual defense alliances, which is this, you get this mutual, you know, this mutual defense alliance between Jehoshaphat and, so that kind of sucked me in, you know, kind of captivated me. And, you know, they were all two, you know, Russia and Serbia had a mutual defense alliance. Germany and Austria-Hungary, France and Russia, Britain and France, Belgium and Japan and Britain. So you had all this, and another was imperialism, militarism, nationalism, and then leading up to what, you know, the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. Whether or not you look back at history, and there seems to be some reason, you know, some reasonable support, plausible support, that was actually like scripted, as it were, because they were so close to war and they wanted war, the powers that be at that time, because some would benefit from it, that they that was the final catalyst. They knew it, so they made sure that it happened. But again, the interesting part is that the Ahab in that 10-tribe kingdom, if it represents the church state, you know, of the papacy, that and Ahab did essentially cease to exist a fair amount of time prior to Jezebel, who really, you know, represents the actual the papacy, you know, itself. That I don't know. It seems more. It feels better to me. I'll put it, is that a good way to put it? Do you have something that feels better than so? I like it because we know what comes later with Jehu and the death of Jezebel. It's a completely kind of a radically different picture, even though it ends the same way with her death and dogs and that kind of thing.
Well, I'll give just a response to that. I think anything we have, we're going to feel here because we don't have a lot of stuff to hang on. But taking that back to World War II, and you mentioned about the cooperations. In the picture here, all the cooperations are on one side. There's nothing mentioned about cooperation on the other side. And so that would be a discontinuity. The other thing, going all the way back to French Revolution, we have that picture quite nicely just four chapters earlier. It was 1 Kings 18, the Elijah, and then the period of time in the Bible societies and after that. Now, could the Lord repeat that? Absolutely. You know, many of these pictures are repeated again and again. But it's always good to consider possibilities and not rule them out without at least giving them some thought. I wanted to ask a question, and you asked a question, but who does Micaiah represent? All right, go ahead and give it back to me.
Well, I think it's interesting. I'm not necessarily drawing a direct line, but maybe kind of throwing it out there to see if, like, you know, a chicken amongst alligators. that who was a very vocal opponent of the First World War as it was ramping up? Like, who do we know very well that was that? Yeah, Pastor Russell. You know, he was preaching that these, what's the point of this, you know, you've got churches teaching all the churches, remember he was saying, they're all saying, yes, send our young men, join this cause, it's a righteous cause, it's a godly cause, and the pastor is the only one saying, no, it's not, and his reputation suffered because of, you know, he's un-American, he was unpatriotic and everything, and of course, right dead smack in the middle of the conflagration between 1914 and 1918, he dies in 1916, right in the middle, he's gone. So you know, it's like, it's an interesting point, I guess you'd say, but he was castigated very much in the churches and in public opinion and whatnot. Anyone who was anti-war and anti-joining was viewed as being like un-American. And of course, you know, America is what do you want to call it, the righteous and true and just and all.
So, do you suggest Micaiah represents Brother Russell?
I'm not even suggesting. I'm saying it's an interesting correlation that he was so adamantly against this thinking of, you know, fighting this war, because every side, the Germans thought they had God on their side, you know, so everyone had God on their side.
And we do notice that Micaiah was silenced before the battle began. He was put away, we have not heard from him after that. Any other suggestions on who Micaiah represents?
Sister Carrie, please.
Well, I kind of tend to think it might be the feet members, but the Lord would set the stage for the civil power to do the writing. They would have a message to give, and then I kind of think tithing and their days in one person, John Baptist, we consider ourselves to be the John Baptist class. I know there's more to it, but I can't think right now of that.
Yeah, I think as a generalization, I don't think you get too many people who disagree with that. I mean, the timing and whatnot would be open for debate, but the gym after this. But he certainly represents God's prophet, God's messenger on the earth at that time. You know, whether it's the French Revolution or World War I or here at the very end of the age, you know, where I tend to be more comfortable with. We have already suggested that this is one possibility of application, and this is a European type of experience. So it would represent a European brethren being involved in some way in that, at least in terms of getting the message. Brother James.
You have a Micaiah here showing all the prophets of Baal that they are false, you know, prophets.
Exposing them, yep.
That's what Brother Russell did.
He did. Nobody in that. In the 19th and 20th century, it exposed that false religion more than did their pastor. No question about that. We've got about, looks like 7 minutes. I just wanted to take, for example, for a moment, I had looked at and listened to some studies in the past where some of the brethren had suggested that perhaps Syria and King Syria represented the countries of the north, particularly Russia, coming down. And, you know, that was back in the 80s where that was suggested. And we thought about that. Certainly, when we consider the military readiness of Russia right now, a picture like that isn't consistent. However, having said that, if we have an emasculation, if you will, of Europe because of these wars and whatnot, that would certainly open the door for a country that is still strong, not strong enough to be able to stand it now. But if NATO was dissolved, then Russia could certainly be in a position to come down. And most of us think that something like that will happen just prior to the time of Jacob's trouble, in fact, precipitated Jacob's trouble. So I wanted to tie that in with the older suggestion and say what I didn't like about it now, but what I do like about it as the suggestion that we're getting now is it might be a practice set up for that later development. We have 6 minutes left. I'm out of questions, so I'm going to open it up for more questions or comments or whatever. Brother Brandon and then Sister Suzanne.
The other facets that I think are interesting, Zedekiah smites, builds the two horns, and then after the fact, after he says, you know, with these horns ye shall, will push out the Syrians, this is also 3 years of peace. And this is an unprovoked attack by Ahab and Jehoshaphat. So it's not provoked by the Syrians. They're in peace and they're upholding their end of the deal ostensibly. You know, you get no idea that the Syrians provoked anything.
They weren't aggressive at all.
Right. And this is Ben-Hadad, by the way, just for the, I guess for the record, you may have brought that up. I don't remember now. So first, Micaiah, gets beat physically, you know, gets hit physically by the imposter prophet of Jehovah, Zedekiah. And Zedekiah is, you know, the name is good, but he's also the son of a traitor. So, which, you know, I find kind of interesting as well. So just these, you know, these intriguing facets, not to harp on it or anything like that, but there's no question that near the end of his ministry, the pastor is taking a beating, as it were, in the media and, of that day and everything, lawsuits, and it was just really, systematic. They were really trying to bury him, as it were, and they did more or less ultimately accomplish what after his death, but this Ramoth Gilead thing. We're in the same regional area of thinking if we look at it, you know, this Austria-Hungary, centric region. You know, it's still very much in the Yugo region, which is the Balkan region, which I think many have centered on as being antitypically fulfilling of the Ramoth-Gilead picture, which seems to make sense also. And it is just a, I don't know, it's a strange, I guess you could say, I have a little bit of difficulty putting it in the future, simply because we're talking Ahab, Micaiah, Elijah is still on the scene at this time, even though he's not in this picture, so, you know, got to give you that. And it's just a, I don't know, you know, the more I think about it, the more reluctant I am to push it off. You know, Brother Richard and I are going to have a confab over this one, and you can tell me your thoughts.
Sister Suzanne, and then Brother Rick, and then Sister Dawn, and that'll have to be it. No, Brother Rick, and then Sister Dawn.
Well, this is probably not going to be very satisfactory, because it's not a prophetic sense, it's just considering the prophet. Like Jesus, he was presented before two civil leaders, the two kings, which represent Pilate and Herod, and then the 400 prophets would be the religious leaders. The high priest in Sanhedrin with the horns kept provoking Jesus, and Jesus too was smote on the cheek like Micaiah was by the religious element. And Jesus did not have a good word to say to Herod. He didn't say at all. And before Pilate, he gave a little bit more. But nonetheless, the way Pilate said, "Thou art king," and how did Jesus answer? It was almost a little sarcastic. "Thou sayest." But he was getting his point across, just like Micaiah was getting his point across. Well, you're saying it, but I don't need to condemn myself in front of you. But you are testifying that it's true. And then Jesus was, of course, in prison. Micaiah ended up being in prison. But neither one worried about that. But I was particularly impressed with the shortness of how Micaiah answered it. So often that's true with the prophet and Jesus, who said very little but said enough. And with James and John, when they were called before the high priest for preaching Jesus, they just said what they need to say. We've got to obey the law of God. That's how you kind of view Micaiah's answer. Well, I'm just got to say what the Lord tells me to say. But he doesn't get into a tirade like, "I can't find me all." We really appreciate that, because we might, you know, why not? It's good to observe how they react. So, actually, I got to say that's what I was thinking of.
Wow. That never crossed my mind that there's a number of parallelisms there. Very good for you. All right, last comment.
Okay, Brother Rick said it much more completely than I could have, but just one additional comment, and that is that the prophecy put Micaiah into prison. That sounds like John the Baptist.
Yeah, very good. Brother, thank you very much. I have to say that I approach this study with a lot more fear and trepidation than I do with Song of Solomon, because there's so many unknowns here. And as you can see in this very energetic discussion that we had, there's different ways to apply this. And we can't just rule out anyone because we don't like it. They're all there that are useful to consider. Remember, one of the objects of studying prophecy is not to say, well, we predicted the future, we can predict the future, but it prepares us to watch what's taking place in our own world every day. And as we see these things, we'll be able to link the things up, do so with confidence in our Father, enjoy and knowing the outcome. Thank you very much for making Legend of Easy, sir.